Well, welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I'm here with Corey Pollard. We had the pleasure of meeting through a former guest on my podcast, Ping Lu. We both share a passion for men and women who are either incarcerated or formerly incarcerated. Professionally, Corey has over 30 years of experience in in-depth motion picture and television production strategy, management, and delivering experience. I don't know what all that means, but I think when I keep going here, people will. Currently, I believe you are the first assistant director on Chicago Fire. You can probably elaborate on that. But you've been involved in a number of different shows, such as Jack Ryan, Grey's Anatomy, Nashville, House MD, just to name a few. So,
fancy.
Clearly you've done some stuff now, and you're calling us in today from Chicago, right?
I am. I'm in Chicago right now working on Chicago Fire.
All right. Well, thank you for taking the time and very much interested to hear your story a little bit more. Give us all a little background of where you grew up, maybe where you went to school, and then just a high level of your career.
You know, I'm a bumpkin who was born in Walla Walla, Washington. I moved to the big city, Eugene, and graduated from high school in the bigger city, Springfield, Oregon. No, actually, Springfield's even smaller.
Yes, it is.
And I ran away and joined the circus right out of high school. I moved to Hollywood, was pursuing the dream of working in the business. I've had some pretty interesting experiences. Even before I left Oregon, I was very fortunate that Rob Reiner came to Eugene to make a film that turned out to be a classic film. And I ended up with a small role in it and it changed my life. He cast me in a movie called Stand By Me. I got to work with some pretty amazing actors. I met one of my heroes, Richard Dreyfuss, on that. And John Cusack played a small role in River Phoenix, and God bless him, Corey Feldman. Like, you know, I had a very interesting teen years, to say the least. And moving to Hollywood felt like a solution to get me toward my dreams. The high level of my career, I literally started as an extra at 12 years old, fell in love with the process of being on a set. I was allowed to be an extra in a movie that was shot in Eugene. And then at 16, that Stand By Me thing happened. And by the time I was 18, I was down in Los Angeles and I started moving furniture, literally as a furniture mover. And now 33 years later, I am what's called a first assistant director, and I've produced a film, and I'm in the process of launching a production company, Unincarcerated Productions, which is a kind of exciting big deal. And I just love the camaraderie it takes to make film projects. So I'm a guy that is responsible for everything and control of nothing right now as the assistant director. And I hope to be the guy that brings the people and the money together to produce projects that have an impact and change people with those projects.
So I got to stop for a second because we have had a discussion about this before, but I think it's important that we make this verbal to the world. I am a massive Oregon Duck fan. And are you right there with me?
Yes. Since the early 70s, I didn't miss a home game when I was growing up. And it's a big part of my life.
Do you remember, and I could be wrong on this, I thought at one time the cheerleaders would come in on, I thought it was a fire engine, but I could be wrong. But
yeah, no, there was a fire engine.
They would throw out the little footballs. And I always wanted to catch one. I never did.
Oh, I got them. I had a bunch of them as a kid. I wish I still had them. I had probably three or four of them. Yeah, they were the greatest. They were the miniature footballs.
Yeah.
Remember that with the big O on it? And then the whole rebranding thing happened when Phil Knight got involved, and you look at all that and you just think, wow, it's a great small town to be from.
So let me ask you a quick question. You said, I mean, obviously you went straight into Hollywood. You implied something about, you know, your dreams. What were your dreams at that time period of going into Hollywood? What took you there?
You know, as a kid with substance abuse problems coming out of Oregon, I thought I wanted to be a movie star. I really thought that would be it. You know, and then the Rob Reiner thing happened and there was opportunities that were you know, within grasp, but I just couldn't even hold it together long enough to show up for auditions and things because of the issues that I had. And so I moved here knowing that that probably wasn't the thing. When I moved to Los Angeles, I landed in Los Angeles before grunge was grunge in LA. This was 88 and it was a thing. We were those grunge kids. I was the punker who grew his hair out. I had a man bun in 1988.
Oh, wow.
That's not a new thing. These kids act like they've got something on it. I was one androgynous looking odd dude. And when I landed in LA, people didn't know what I was. I was a golfer. And really? Businessmen wouldn't golf with me. Yeah, because they thought, we don't understand. You look like a stoner. Well, I was. But I couldn't golf with people because they just thought, well, we won't let people like you on the course. And it was an interesting time to be in LA. I had one woman walk up to me at an art installation. She was looking at art on the walls, and she walked around me in my combat boots and my jeans with layers and holes in the knees. And she literally looked at me like I was a piece of art up and down and said, well, that's a very interesting field and stream look. And I thought, well, she goes, you look like you're from Topanga. Like, what does that mean? And over the course of about 4 weeks, other people like, hey, dude, are you from Topanga? I'm like, what is this? So I finally asked this actor friend of mine that I was living with. I'm like, Christoph, why do people ask me if I'm from Topanga? What is that? Are they dissing me? What does that mean? Well, Topanga Canyon is a canyon. It's actually where Manson had his escapades, but it's literally just outside the city. It is the most unbelievably cool rural area. And he drove me up there on a Wednesday, and by Friday I had a place there. Cause you know what? I was from Topanga. It was Oregon. Yeah. I mean, it was like literally a piece of Oregon in the middle of the, and so there I found my little home and I was there, but I really didn't know what my plan was moving to LA. I had $150.
Oh, wow.
A car full of contraband. And that was what I took to Los Angeles with me. And stupidly, just 2 hours from LA, I got tired and I pulled off and spent half my money on a hotel room and a $9 room service beer at 18. I was paranoid. I wasn't going to get it. I got the beer and I was so proud of myself. Got in the car the next morning and drove 2 hours and went, really? I'm half broke. And I could have just driven another 2 hours and gotten here. Like, it was so dumb. I was just such a young idiot. And what ended up happening was an opportunity from a movie I worked on in Oregon. There was a period where I actually worked as a set dresser on a movie. And these people were like, you're great. You're going to work all the time. You don't need to go to school. I did have a Pell Grant for a film school in LA that I thought I was going to go to. And within 2 weeks, I got a phone call. And it wasn't from any of the people I had worked with. And I thought, that's really weird. So I went to the interview and the guy's like, oh yeah, you come highly recommended by this guy. I'm like, I don't know that guy. He's like, well, you shouldn't be telling me that. I'm like, well, I don't know him. He's like, you're an idiot. And he gets on the guy on the phone. And this guy goes, oh, no, no, no. I haven't worked with Corey. He just came highly recommended by this guy. Huh. And he says, this guy. And I go, I don't know that guy. He goes, dude, I am about to ask you to leave. Like, seriously, why are you even here? I was like, I don't know. He calls that guy. The guy goes, oh, no, 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 no. Greg Grande gave me his number. He hung up the phone and goes, you're hired. Greg Grande recommended you. Greg Grande was a guy I worked with in Oregon who ended up, he's a really big production designer now. He did the show Friends and
oh, wow. Okay.
A lot of really big shows. And that was my introduction to how, oh my gosh, is that called social capital? Where an impact I had on one human being.
Yeah.
He had a huge capital around him. And literally three people deep, he gave my name to one person who gave my name to another person, said, Greg thinks he's great. Greg thinks he's great. Got to the fourth man, third man rather. Mm. And there it is. And that was my introduction to Hollywood. And I was a furniture mover on a movie called The Fabulous Baker Boys. I just moved furniture and pianos. That's what I did. Super interesting.
I know we could talk for an hour here, but I'm going to try to keep us going in sure. a direction. We're going to skip ahead to today. And I'm sure there's a lot that's transpired over your life. How would you describe yourself in the context of where you currently are in your life journey?
I would describe myself as a gratefully sober human being with a love for God that has transformed my entire life into something that I can't even imagine. My greatest dreams that I thought I had were not met, but even greater things have happened. The reality that a skill set was inside of me that I had no idea existed to organize these massive projects, considering I don't have an education. I didn't ever end up at that film school. I worked, deferred my tuition, worked, left, came back and said, oh my gosh, Sir Bernard Hunt was the guy's name. I need to defer my tuition again. And he said, get out of here. You're doing what everybody wants. And I never went back. And as a result, I literally have become a guy who lives in the moment, takes these massive projects and just peels them back and asks a lot of questions and just tries to, you know, your stewardship's a part of your mm-hmm. program here. I'm a servant leader. I'm a good steward of all that, you know, it's handed to me. And I really try hard to manage every person on the project. It's not about the movie stars. It's not about anything more than what are the details? How are we all going to get to the finish line on a budget, on a schedule, and solve these problems? And it's not me. I mean, I literally feel like Forrest Gump. I feel like Mr. Magoo just stepping off the end of the girder. Like I have no idea how any of these projects are ever going to fully come together, but somehow I have a skill set that sees things differently than a lot of different people. And people, they get made all the time. There are plenty of assistant directors out there, but I hear over and over that people really enjoy the sets that I work on because I keep it light.
Would your cast members or whatever associates say that you manage or you lead differently today than you did 20 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. I've worked with a number of them pre-sobriety and post-sobriety and even some in sobriety and then, you know, years into it now because I've got I'm right at 15 years actually now of 5,478 days today. Still count the days. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you get more seasoned, you go through some things and there suddenly are no more big deals and you just kind of do it. And that's what I really enjoy about it is, again, that's a social capital that I get people tell me, oh, we were so excited to see that your name was here, that you were going to be here. We're so glad that you're here. And there was a time when people were like, oh no,
not him.
Not that guy. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
All right. So here's another big kind of question is, how are you trying to change the world? Whether that be big or whether it be small, how are you trying to change the world?
Well, you and I have talked offline about this a little bit. Unincarcerated Productions is a production company I'm involved with a couple of formerly incarcerated individuals. And it's a verb. It's a noun, like unincarceration of your mind. You know, and I love doing it with my love for God and working with people who don't peddle Jesus to get you to do their program. I'm working with folks in prisons prior to COVID, and we're creating vocational training for filmmaking. We're creating job opportunities, a pipeline to business job opportunities. And it's not just a production company. We're literally creating economy and opportunity for the unincarcerated who are coming out, the newly unincarcerated, the people who are on the outside, the wives, the kids. We're putting together sales teams with other book firms and people that need salespeople and creating opportunity for the incarcerated, you know, the unincarcerated individual, for the wife or the spouse of someone who's in prison so that the stigma is lifted from them. So my hope is to just continue to work in that community, to take whatever I have to do to make the Hollywood things and turn around my energy and my money into doing these projects. That's where I'd much rather be.
Well, that's obviously how we met and, and immediately hit it off. And, I've obviously been very much enjoyed our friendship here that we just started over the last month or so.
Even begun yet.
Yeah, I know. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm excited too.
All right. So, you're in Hollywood and one of the attributes of Hollywood is money. And so, when did you realize the power of capital?
I had two really distinct experiences in the same region of Mexico. I've always realized educationally that I have a social capital. I have really worked hard because I didn't get the film school education that I thought I needed or wanted. And I see folks coming out of film schools ill-prepared for the reality of what this industry is. So I spend a lot of time taking my social capital and breaking the fourth wall for groups of students. Prior to COVID, I would have like 5 and 10 kids come from these schools that I speak at and get them to stay a day on the set. Sometimes I'd hire 10 of them as an extra and let them be there and watch and then be able to engage with them as I'm setting up a scene and doing these things. And I feel like that's a huge social capital. That's something that I was on the advisory board for a film school called Compass College of the Cinematic Arts. We took it from being a trade school all the way through to an accredited program. And we were one of the few schools that could get kids these amazing internships as a result of the Hollywood connection. It was this school in the middle of nowhere, Grand Rapids, Michigan. And it was, we were getting kids, you know, my friend Mark Klayman, who's a producer, he produced the movie, The Pursuit of Happiness. If you ever saw that.
It's a great movie. Yeah.
And so Mark was our guy that I brought in line to be the man in charge of getting us internships. So while he was out there peddling his projects, he was getting internships, and he was getting internships for kids from Grand Rapids, Michigan over NYC, UCLA, USC, and all these big film schools. And so that was the one place where I saw that, my position in Hollywood, spending time with these students and then coming back to Hollywood and going, hey, I've got these kids I'd like to bring to the set. And many of them have gotten in the industry. I've worked with some of them, two of them from Southeastern University got into the Guild, and I saw them at General Directors Guild of America meetings, and they'd never reached out to me beyond the encouragement that I gave them in the classes that I was a part of. And then they walked up to me, Mr. Pollard, do you remember? I'm like, yes, I remember you from Southwestern. Why are you here? We're in the Directors Guild of America. And I'm like, what? Cool. You didn't even call me for a job?
Yeah.
The other place where I saw an interesting thing about filmmaking, it takes a lot of money and a lot of people to do it. And I've been very fortunate. I've traveled internationally. I've worked in a lot of different places. And the experience I had in Mexico, in the state of we were in San Miguel Allende, which is in the state of Guanajuato. And it's up in the mountains. Went there for this movie, for working with Robert Rodriguez. And we hired all these extras. And yet on the day we were shooting, I was setting the extras. Extras are the folks that you see, like if you walk into the Mexican town and you see all the people around sitting down, making the tortilla, like all of that. We had all that set up. But there was one guy that caught Robert Rodriguez's eye and my eye, who was not a part of our team that we had hired. He was just being him sitting across the way. And I thought, man, he goes, I love that. Let's see if that guy will stay. I'm like, okay. I ran over to the guy and I said, hey, you know, would you mind staying here for the next 4 or 5 hours? I'll pay you. He's like, you'll pay me? I said, yeah. And I handed him 200 pesos and he wept. I said, what? He goes, I haven't been able to find work and my family's hungry. I said, well, we're going to feed you. Bring your family to lunch. And he brought his family. And I went, oh, wow. If I can be a part of where projects are going when they're made, there's a way to take that money and spend it wisely, plus my educational background. So my big fantasy, unincarcerated is one way. The other way is the reality. It's the same thing. In unincarcerated, we're going to be telling stories of people in prison. They don't get access to the money when we take the rights to their story. It goes into an account outside that is for the reparation. Mm-hmm. It's for the victims. And then anything left over is for their families. And it's a hard battle. We're working on legislation to do this stuff. Well, I want to do that in areas in LA and areas in the country rather, and in other parts of the world where that's necessary. So take a group, invest in a project, take it there, educate people, teach them how to make the project, teach them how to then maybe invest their money into their community. Mm-hmm. Here, you've got this money. Now here's a micro lender. Let's figure out what do you need to do for your village, for your town, for your space. So that's a big part of it. So I realized on that job that social capital was huge and that I could help other people. So I go back to San Miguel Allende for another movie 6 months later. And that same producers fell in love with this region. And the exchange rate was so great. A $27 million movie became a $40 million movie. And so we went back. And it was a battle movie, and the battle movie needed lots of extras. And I kept looking at shooting in 7 different cities and what it would be like to get extras in every city. But what if I had 180 people from one town that we were staged in and traveled them with me? What would that look like? And so I did all the math with the accountant. He goes, this actually saves the company money. Wow. But it was a fight with the producers because they couldn't see it. And so we went on for about 3 weeks. And finally, the accountant threw the numbers down and they went, okay. So I hired 180 people that were able to quit their jobs because they were making more with me in 6 months than they'd made in 2 years. And the gratitude and the camaraderie and the, so those are two areas where I really realized, I think it was both just, you know, capital and good steward. It was an opportunity that I had the balls because of where my heart was to push something in a direction and not just do what I was told. And it saved the company money. Oh, great. So I saved the corporation money and changed lives. Double bottom line. I'm looking for the triple bottom line. I'm looking for the kingdom bottom line.
So you may have already answered this question, and I love what you just described, but and maybe answer this question just as it relates to you and how you live or however you want. But What does stewardship mean to me, to you? And wow. I see that you, some of that, you've already played some of that out, but can you articulate any more?
Yeah. You know, for me, stewardship really means being present to the opportunity that's there. You know, there's the talent guy, the talent stories in the Bible, these, you know, the reality.
Yeah. That, parable of the talents.
Yeah. And so the reality of that is, yeah, I could hide everything that I have. I could hide all my good ideas. I could, mm-hmm. I feel like I have a robust mind for a reason, because I tried to kill this mind. I worked really hard in the substance abuse world. The fact that I'm articulate, sober, vivacious, and have the ability to speak is mind-boggling, that I'm not brain damaged. It's a gift. And so when some of those crazy ideas like Unincarcerated Productions comes to me, or the idea to take one guy and turn it into 180 guys on the next, or it was families too, because in Mexico you can hire the kids. Like, it was crazy. When you think of something like that, for me, I've got to be a good steward. Some of these things I just write down.
Yeah.
And I just say, all right, Lord, if it's your will, show me, because that's crazy. That's crazy. But I've seen crazy come off the page. I've seen, you know, unthinkable things. So being a good steward to me is not diving down every rabbit hole, but being surrendered to, okay, is this a really a good idea? Because I have a lot of good ideas, but is it your idea? Mm-hmm. I want to be a good steward of what God gives me. I don't want to build something that I'm not being called to, which is crazy when you look at my career in Hollywood and how unchristian many of my projects might look like. I'm there for the purpose that God has, not to make me look like I belong somewhere. I'm there because I feel I'm told to walk in and be able to talk to people that a lot of people who believe religion stuff wouldn't go to. And to me, that's being a good steward of the life I was given. I've been given an experience level with drugs, alcohol, and Hollywood that gives me capital that I could just walk away and make a living in a church and talk about God, or I could try to be Christ in the world that he places me and hope I don't get eaten alive. He's bigger. He's way bigger.
You know, it's interesting. You just, and I don't even think you realize this. So you're talking about, you have an idea, you put it on paper and you try to execute it. But what's interesting in that discussion, and I'm sure you do think about this, but risk, you're taking risk.
Every day.
And yet
every job I sign up for is I have no idea if we're ever going to deliver anything. You know, the number of people, the moving parts, the personalities, and a lot of it is danger. There's a lot of, I got a bit of a action background, a little bit of, you know, Sunday I'm doing a huge fire. Like we're burning a homeless encampment and blowing up a propane tank in the middle of it all, knocking a guy down.
Well, so how do you personally think about risk? Do you even think about it, or do you just go do it?
I sort of just go do it. It's an interesting thing. We were talking about this on the set the other day with the other first AD. He's like, man, I still, every one of these events that we shoot, I lose sleep the night before. And I'm like, I don't lose sleep. I just sort of, the risk is there, and being present allows me to make wise decisions. Again, it's a stewardship thing. It's like you can think about a lot of things and you can think about a lot of different angles, but sometimes it's the Mr. Magoo move that's the thing. And if, you know, you and I have talked about this before, for those of you that maybe don't know what Mr. Magoo is, but it was a cartoon and the guy walked out his door without his glasses one day and he just narrowly averts every disaster. He doesn't see it coming. Everybody around him is going, I feel like Mr. Magoo. I feel like Forrest Gump. Like if you look at the picture, if you go through my internet movie database page and in at the schools I go to, they put this up and I try to make sure I'm not in the room, because I just listen to all these things. And I turn around like, who in the heck? Oh, that was me.
Yeah.
I was a part of all that. I'm just there solving little problems. That's my function. I am a servant leader. That's all I do, is just solve people's problems for a living. You know, it's insane. So I really think I weigh risk. Safety is a very big thing for me.
Right.
But I've been so well trained that I can understand and assess a lot of things. It's not arrogance. It's wisdom, I think. You know, there's a certain level of discernment that comes when we do things over and over, and hopefully you don't make the same mistakes. You know, and I'm not, so Lord willing, tomorrow nobody's going to get hurt, or Sunday rather, on my shoot. You know, so far, people go to the hospital sometimes because they're taking huge risks themselves, these stunt people. Like what you guys watch and think is easy, is it's really happening. They're really doing this stuff. It's not exactly.
I don't think we have an appreciation for that.
No, people don't. And that's another thing that I talked about, breaking that fourth wall earlier. My favorite thing on the planet, and someday when COVID's not a thing, I'm going to get you on a set with me. You're going to come and watch something happen. We're going to sit down at lunch and you're going to go, what?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? The amount of effort and money and stuff it takes to shoot two people sitting in a room. You'll go, there were 30 people in that room with those two people kissing. Yep. Yep. And then when it gets to street scene, it's even bigger. It's just, and I love it. It's the risk, I think, that drives me. So the answer to the question is, I think that risk is incredibly necessary, because without risk, there's not a reward. You know, if I can't, and so again, those ideas that I write down, and they're coming out Unincarcerated. Our podcast is being launched. The books are being written. Like, things are happening because I didn't just sit on it anymore. It felt like when I met another man, Spencer Oberg, I think you're going to end up with him over here.
Yep.
Met him. You just go, there's a click. There's a click. Let's just try. I think it's all, you know, because I think people gain more by risking and failing than sitting back and wondering.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you use the parable of the talents, because I guess it was probably about 5 years ago, I had left corporate America and had this idea about impact investing. And, you know, it's like, am I crazy? Is this even real? And, you know, why even take the risk? The chances of this, you know, coming in and this little fish competing in this big old ocean. And it was actually, and I was at a California at a conference, and we were talking about the parable of the talents. And what struck me was all four of the quote unquote servants who were bestowed capital. The first two, as you know, went out and used it and multiplied it. And the third one, you know, hit it. And the master comes back and is obviously thrilled with the first two, but he's very disappointed. And what hit me was, it was this idea of risk. In the financial services, I'm so used to, everything's got to be, and you still need to be thoughtful. But for me personally, then, to actually go do Common Good Capital, I had to get over this risk and go, I'm called to be faithful.
Yes.
That's it.
That's what I love about our stories. When we shared that the other night with Ping, I so identified with that with you, because I had the same thing happen about 3 years ago. I thought the risk was I made it to Hollywood and I had a comfortable career in a career in an industry where most people can't get a job. And yet I've not stopped working for 33 years and I got comfortable in that space. Mm-hmm. But these ideas were written down, these things that I want to do, these dreams that I wanted to reach for. I was in the dream machine, but just dead. And I had to stop, let myself be cleansed, take a 2-year detox, and start these other things. I had to do it. That's where I became, only in the last 2 years. I've always taken risks. The action, doing all the things that I do professionally in Hollywood is a risk. But the bigger risk is stepping toward the dream. And I'm so glad you're doing the impact stuff and the reality of that, because it is exactly what the world needs, as much as what we're trying to do with Unincarcerated, all that stuff. People have to take these risks.
Yeah.
Because there is an economy that exists outside what we think the economy is in our country and our world. And without guys like you and I that think differently, we'll never know.
Well, I don't want to get into the political side of things, but I will say one thing. You know, even in this whole pandemic thing, I think part of it is we're trying to act like there isn't risk in life and everything we do. And we've chosen this one thing and we're trying to control it. And you go,
no, yeah,
I don't know that that's the right way
it's
to do
not.
It.
And the American dream can be a shackle without risk. If you're just looking to pay the bills and like create this machine that you're paying the bills, oh my gosh, I did it. But the reality is, there's living is a different thing than just having a life.
Yep. No, you're right.
I want to live and live abundantly. And I've experienced abundance in the time of COVID. And I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about the growth. I'm talking about the risk that I took to take steps toward our dreams. And we started producing stuff even in the pandemic. We were doing stuff like this on Zoom. And that's beginning to give us traction. And it's super fun to watch this happen, because I could have just sat here and looked at my navel and wondered when God was going to give me a job back in Hollywood. But, you know, I just love that our stories intersect in that same way. We both woke up as these kind of workaholic guys going, yep, there's way more than this. There's way more than this.
Last question for you. If you could make one dream come true for your life, what would it be?
Oh man, that's such a hard question.
I know. It's a brutal question.
But you know what? It's actually coming true right now in doing these podcasts, like this podcast with you and producing the podcast that I'm doing. I would actually love to have my conversations become my living. And by that, I mean, what's happening, like unincarcerated, starting as a conversation. I don't mind doing the work. I'm not saying I want to just sit and talk for a living, but I have been bringing other people's pages to life, other people's dreams, other people's visions to life. I would like to actualize some of the stories I feel like I have, not just inside of me, but other people I've connected with. Like, you know, we've got the rights to two stories. Two lives, actually. It's not their story. It's two lives that we're dealing with Billy Wayne Sinclair and his wife, Jody, that are phenomenal stories of redemption. I'm not talking about Jesus stuff. I'm talking about a guy who was on death row.
Yep.
And what happened, why he was there, politically what happened to him, and how he and the two of them for 25 years fought the system, and he's now out. And they're living their lives together. Like, I want to be a guy who tells those stories. And I do today. Chevrolet does not know they want to advertise on my stuff, but I'll tell you what, when they see the reality of the economy behind what we're doing, people are going to want to invest in what we're up to. And that is my dream, is that people want to invest in something that has a double bottom line, that has absolute impact. And that's what we're trying to do at Unincarcerated. Did that answer it?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting is I'll reference Ping, who we both have a relationship with. And you
love that guy.
And you look at his story. And on one hand, it's tragic.
Yeah.
On the other hand, his attitude, perseverance, and frankly, love in this, what a gift.
I was there right when he got out. I got to go to his first apartment. And I thought it was amazing. He's like, yeah, for now. And now look at where he is in New Jersey, this big house. Like, yeah. I'm grateful for people like that. And that is what helped unincarcerate my mind about this population that you and I both have a passion for, is that they are not any different than you and I.
Right.
There are people who should never get out. There are people who have absolutely gotten themselves into a position in their lives, but then there are people whose hearts and minds are being changed who can't afford to get out. And Unincarcerated, we hope, is helping people get opportunity like that.
Well, and it's interesting that the way you guys talk about it, because obviously the prison system is one thing, but you and I and everybody comes across people outside the prison walls who are just as imprisoned. So these are complicated issues, but it's stuff we all need to be thinking about and learn from.
Yep.
So, yeah.
For sure. Well, thank you so much for having me on, dude. This was amazing. I'm so glad to know you.
Yeah, no, this is fun. And we'll make sure that we get your name out there with Unincarcerated. And don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to more fulfilling portfolios within the impact investing space. Till next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.